You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko se whea tōku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host Sophia and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Otto. Coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I speak to ACT MP Laura Trask about public sector job cuts, new sentencing laws for youth offenders, and the Māori Wards Bill. I also speak to Dr. Ella Cullen, the Director of Wellbeing System Leadership at Te Herenga Mahara, the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission, about recent data on the state of youth mental wellbeing in Aotearoa. I also speak to Professor Michael Baker from the University of Otago about forming a global pandemic agreement and New Zealand's current COVID response system. And I speak to the chair of the Coalition for the Safety of Women and Children, Leonie Morris, about the government introducing a bill to make stalking illegal in Aotearoa. Otto, what have you got for us today?
For this week's Get Action, I speak to Diniti Boata from Massey University about a petition of hers calling for the university to divest its investments from the State of Israel. I also speak to Rachel McIntosh from Air 2 Union to discuss the nationwide rallies for care and support workers this week.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wai mai rane, give us a call in the studio on 309 3879. Kaua e ware ware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō hei pakihere rukiruki māronga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95 BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke with ACT MP Laura Trask about public sector job cuts. I started our interview asking her about the over 6,000 public service roles which have already gone or are expected to go. With the number expected to continue to climb, last week ACT Party leader David Seymour said he thinks the government has still not slashed enough public service roles. Additionally, I asked Laura about the government introducing a new young serious offender declaration in an effort to reduce youth offending. This could see some serious youth offenders being sent to a military-style academy or boot camp, which have been met by criticism for their failure to address root causes of youth offending. Lastly, I asked her about the Parliamentary Select Committee recommending last week that the Māori Wards Bill go ahead. The bill, which would reverse changes made to increase Māori representation in local government by reverting the Māori Ward rules to restore the referendum mechanism, has also been met with criticism, namely with the Waitangi Tribunal saying it breaches Te Tiriti or Waitangi. Here is that interview. So I wanted to begin by asking you about public sector job cuts. There's over 6,000 roles already gone or expected to go. And last week, ACT Party leader David Seymour said the government has still not slashed enough public service roles, him having campaigned on cutting 15,000. Would you be able to first elaborate on why the government is cutting so many roles in the public sector and why Seymour thinks 6,000 is not enough?
Yeah, absolutely. So look, under the previous government, so from like 2017 to 2023, we saw a 28% increase in public service staff, so it's quite a lot. It's around 18,000. With this, we obviously saw inflation grow. So we've got a serious economic problem in New Zealand, and one of those things is attributed to the spend of government. I mean, there's plenty of things that contribute to it, but that is one of the core things. And so in order to get the government spending down, we campaigned on it, reducing the waste and obviously cutting some of the public service jobs back to the pre-2017 level. So 6,000 roles have been cut, and saying that there are some frontline service new roles that have established. So Aranga Tamariki, for example, have more frontline staff coming in, and the same with things like customs, for example. So I think that when you level it out, it will actually be a lot less than 6,000. But there are roles being cut, and I do sympathise with those people that are losing their jobs, because it is a horrible time to be in with this economic crisis that we have.
To kind of add on to what you're saying there, it is hard on these people, and at many public servants have said that they have gone to Australia for jobs as a result, because the job market in New Zealand isn't giving them any options. Do you think it's fair to lay off so many of these people considering the current job market in Aotearoa?
Look, I think that it's not just the public service, it's across the board. Like, we are hearing the private sector as well having to lay off staff. I do not want to see good talent moving across to Australia, and I wish that we had an economy where we could support these roles elsewhere. So I 100% agree with you. I don't want to see good talented Kiwis moving across to Australia, and I hope that we can turn this economy around, create more jobs here locally so that people can actually stay. But the problem is, the issue is what we have right now in front of us. And in order to get the economy moving, we need to reduce inflation.
All right, moving on. So it's been announced that a new young serious offender declaration will be introduced. Under this, serious young offenders could be sent to a military-style academy or boot camp. ACT MP Karen Shaw said that the interventions under the new declaration will improve young offenders' lives. And I understand this is an effort to reduce youth offending, but how will these military-style academies benefit offenders' lives, as Shaw said?
Yeah, so basically adding the category in enables the judges, when sentencing, if there has been some quite serious crimes, to have somewhere else for these youth to go. So at the moment, they'll go within to a youth justice facility, and there's no real definite programs that they've been put through. So often they're serving sort of their time, and then they're heading back out into the community. And so with the boot camps, it's sort of like a revamped version of what we've seen in the past. However, it focuses more on the actual wraparound than the boot camp itself. So the boot camp is a small component of that, and it may not be suitable for all of the young offenders. They'll be screened first to check if they've got, underlying conditions, whether it might be neurodiversity, for example, and then they'll be popped within a course or a program, and the boot camp is a small part of that, and then the follow-on is what happens over the following 12 months and back in with the community itself. So it's sort of like, while it is a boot camp as part of it, that is just a very small component of the program in general.
And I mean, considering that young offenders often have histories of trauma, poverty and family issues, research into these military-style interventions has found that those with a rehabilitative component are most effective at reducing reoffending. If the rehabilitative aspect of a boot camp or military-style intervention is what makes it most effective, why has the government insisted on keeping a military-style component at all?
Yeah, look, I agree. I think the rehabilitative side of things is the most effective. But what we have actually seen with boot camps before is that they are really effective in that first sort of month or two when people have left the boot camp. It's what happens after that. So what we're trying to do is capture the good parts from the boot camps themselves, which are around the structure, the discipline, ensuring that children or young people or youth themselves actually have these boundaries and consequences put in place, but then making sure that they also have all of these other serious concerns that lead to the offending addressed. So it's about finding that balance between the two, and I think that we've got a really positive program, and I think that we'll see a really great outcome from it.
All right, moving on. I wanted to ask about Māori wards. So last week, the Parliamentary Select Committee recommended the Māori wards bill go ahead. This was despite the Waitangi Tribunal having said the bill breaches Te Tiriti o Waitangi and the treaty partnership it envisaged. ACT has voiced its opposition of Māori wards, and Seymour has said he's, quote, not really sure why we take a period of time 200 years ago and decide to privilege some humans over others, end quote. However, the aim of Māori wards is to ensure Māori are represented in local government decision-making as an effort to rebalance historical inequity. Why is having this dedicated Māori voice in local government something ACT wouldn't want?
Look, I think that's not true. We do actually want Māori voice within local government and central government. I think we actually already have a really good balance. We've got quite a lot of Māori consultation back to government. We have like local iwi consulting to council, for example. When we talk about the elected officials, we're getting into our democracy. So if we're going to be changing our democratic structure, we think it's most fair that the general public get a say on that, because that's our actual democracy that we're talking about. And it's not about reducing minority voice or making sure that we, you know, minorities don't have a say. That's absolutely not correct. What it is making sure that if we are going to make a change, and some councils very well will want to keep their Māori wards, then those people, those local people in those constituencies actually get that voice and they get to decide. And we may see some stay and we may see some go. And it's just about upholding the democracy when it comes to that. Absolutely, I agree. I think we need Māori voice within local and central government. And I think we are actually getting a really good amount of consultation coming back through more and more over the last, at least, especially the last 4 or 5 years.
Right. So will this government introduce a different measure to make a dedicated space for a Māori voice in local councils then?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't think we'll be making any additional. Look, I think if we look at local council currently and we look at the makeup of their consultation and who they have coming in to give policy advice, for example, we've got a lot of Māori representation. And if we actually just look at the people that are elected into local and central government, we are seeing a lot of Māori representation. I don't think that we need any extra provisions in place that make things mandatory. I think as a society, we are seeing those changes happen regardless.
That was ACT MP Laura Trask speaking to me about public sector job cuts, military-style academies for youth offenders, and ACT's stance on Māori wards.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Text us in on 5395 if you have any thoughts on these pieces. We'll be right back. Keep it on the B.
Hear the air squeeze out of my squeeze box. Insult to nothing, cause Jesus, it stops. Hear the air, hear the air, hear the air, hear the air. Our little man in the Colosseum and the singing, it stops. While in Canton, a Buddha. Insult to nothing, cause Jesus, it starts. I hear the air, I hear the air, I hear the air, I hear the air. Our little man in the Colosseum and the singing, it stops. While in faraway Canton, a Buddha weeps. Yes, he weeps. Mother, your sister, your brother.
you know, our call is fuck normal. Sorry, I swore. It's important.
That's okay. It's BFM.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Driven by a need to ensure the world is better prepared for future pandemics, for the past 2 years, the World Health Organization's 194 member states have been negotiating an international accord on pandemic prevention, preparedness, and response. While it initially aimed to have reached an agreement by last month, talks have been extended. I spoke to Professor Michael Baker from the Department of Public Health at the University of Otago about what a global pandemic treaty might look like, as well as asking him about New Zealand's current response systems to COVID-19. So, World Health Organization member states have been negotiating for 2 years on forming this global pandemic agreement, and while it initially aimed for an agreement last month, talks have been extended. Just firstly, why do you think it's taken the international community so long to form an agreement?
Yes, well, I think the other context, of course, is that the World Health Assembly did agree to the International Health Regulations revision. And so that was a great milestone. I mean, the IHR 2005 was a huge advance in thinking about managing pandemics. And this revision was fairly modest, but even that had to be toned down to get all 194 countries to agree to it. So that was one step. Now, the pandemic agreement was also being negotiated in parallel, and it was far broader in terms of its aspirations, and that didn't get over the line. It still had quite a bit more work to do, and it's partly because it's advocating for a much broader range of changes, and the major point really is that wealthy countries need to support the developing world more so that they have the capabilities to manage pandemics.
And so the World Health Assembly has passed by consensus several important amendments to the international health regulations. However, not all proposed amendments were achieved. Can you briefly talk through these? Just what can we expect to come out of this agreement, do you think?
Yeah, well, I think you're right. Some of the things in the agreement will pick up on points that weren't included in the IHR. And these were things like preventing zoonotic spillovers from animals. That's the One Health approach, because most new emerging infections that cause pandemics come from animals. And we're seeing that playing out now, unfortunately, with avian influenza in the US now established in mammals and cattle for the first time. And that's spilling over to infect humans. And, for example, cats and other animals have contact with cows. So that's quite worrying. And there was a hope that would be more represented in the international health regulations. So now it hopefully will be picked up in the pandemic agreement. The other big area is around sharing of scientific data and specimen. And that is that early on in the pandemic, where it's occurring, scientists and doctors will be collecting specimens from affected people and perhaps animals as well. And that's really vital in rapidly developing vaccines and tests and so on, so that you can actually manage the outbreak or potential pandemic as it's spreading. And we saw that in China with COVID-19. Fortunately, health authorities there were reasonably quick in making the sequences of that virus available, so the world could start developing vaccines immediately and also tests, because these have to be very specific. So that's the second area that's not well covered by the IHR but could be in this pandemic agreement. Another area is accountability, so that countries do have to be very transparent in what's happening. And that's been a limitation with the IHR. And we even saw it in China with COVID-19, that there were unfortunately delays in saying that this virus is now transmitting between people. We went through quite a bit of January with that being a bit uncertain, when in fact, it was very clear to local authorities it was the beginning of a pandemic, and that really delayed the opportunity to stamp it out at source. The other areas are really around making more resources available for low-income countries, and we unfortunately saw this with the COVID vaccine, where supply is always going to be limited early on, and you saw it, the vaccine being almost hoarded by high-income countries, and they actually ordered far more vaccine than they needed for their population, and that's partly political reasons, and it meant that low-income countries were further down the queue. And I think, and understandably, that is an area where, when you have all countries in the world represented at the World Health Assembly, is going to be a major debating point.
To kind of add on to what you're saying there, why do you think it's so important for the international community to have this agreement as opposed to states each managing and controlling COVID infections individually? Why do we need global cooperation here?
Well, there's certain threats where we are all in it together, and they are pretty obvious. It's pandemics that spread globally. It's climate change, which obviously we're all affected by that. It's various forms of pollution of the air and the oceans. And there's actually scores of international agreements that have arisen over decades to try and manage these collective threats. And pandemics are just one of them. But surely now there must be huge momentum globally to get this right, because we've just come out of the worst pandemic for a century, approaching 30 million people dead, catastrophic effects to the global economies, and I think really quite severe effects on political cohesiveness, education and well-being across the globe. And we're still not out of it yet. I mean, we still have an ongoing COVID pandemic. So now you'd think, because we've had such a vivid example of why cooperation is desperately needed, that we would all be supporting this. All countries on earth would be supporting this agreement. But I think it's because of these fracture lines, I think particularly between rich and poorer countries, that is still a sticking point. And I think the group that's been working on this has actually been led by Helen Clark and another world leader. And they had an independent panel, which has been meeting for 3 years. And it's come up with, I think, very strong recommendations for what should be in the pandemic agreement. And a lot of it is around global health equity. So I'm really hoping that we do make advances in this area. There is a timetable over the next year to get this right. But of course, it will be affected hugely by the large number of critical elections that are happening at the moment globally. And that will alter the global consensus environment that we need to get these agreements over the line.
And I wanted to talk about New Zealand's current response. In a recent article with One News, you spoke about New Zealand's business as casual approach to COVID-19. What current systems do we have in place to respond to COVID? Do you think that they are proportionate to the scale of risk and infection in Aotearoa at the moment? Or do you think that we may be getting a bit complacent?
I think we are being very complacent. And as an epidemiologist, I look at the numbers and say, is there cause for concern here? And a lot of it is around mortality, hospitalization, and inequality. You know, they are major things that we need to track. And with COVID-19, we are seeing the way this virus behaves. Unfortunately, it keeps mutating, and some of these mutations give it an advantage, so it gets ahead of our immunity. And we've just coming out now of our sixth major national wave over the last 30 months. And these last three waves have been getting bigger. And so this recent wave, we were seeing over 55 people a day going into hospital, and now 4 to 5 people a day dying from this infection, so about 30 a week. That's a large health impact. It's our number one infectious disease killer in New Zealand, and I think that's a huge concern. The other concern is that a high proportion of people, perhaps between 5 and 14%, will get long COVID. And for some, that will be disabling long term, but certainly many people will be unable to work and attend to their normal activities. And obviously their well-being is hugely reduced because of this infection. So it's having wider effects on productivity in the economy. So I think it ticks all the boxes for a major national concern. We know we have tools. They're not perfect tools, but we have ways of turning down that number of infections. And we've advocated for a integrated respiratory infectious disease strategy for New Zealand to deal with all of these respiratory infections, COVID-19 and also influenza and RSV and so on. And in some respects, New Zealand does have some very good responses. We are fortunately still making COVID-19 vaccine freely available, and that's really the number one protection for people. But other measures we've really, I think, wound back, and it's particularly the support for people to self-isolate when they're sick, because obviously that's a key way of interrupting transmission. And also thinking about other tools like improving indoor air quality, really paying huge attention to that. And I think a particular environment is schools, where you have a lot of students going and now into classrooms where they might have more than 100 students in a single modern learning environment. And that's obviously an environment with this huge risk of transmission of COVID-19 and influenza. And one group who are really adversely affected are the teachers, who are regularly being exposed to these infections. So all of these, this process is really reducing the ability of some of our systems to function like schools. The other environment, of course, is hospitals, where we have, I think, got much less stringent about measures like mask wearing in that environment. And we know that there's a lot of COVID-19 infection actually being acquired in hospitals. And we're not even counting that, but it will be quite a significant amount. And also some people will be dying from that that infection. So there are a lot of things we could do better.
That was Professor of Public Health at the University of Otago, Michael Baker, speaking to me about a global pandemic treaty and how Aotearoa is responding to COVID at the moment.
The Wire.
Amidst the global student protests campaigning against the involvement of academic institutions in Israel's ongoing war in Gaza, many universities in Aotearoa have organized similar protests and issued calls to their universities to disclose their investments and divest from the State of Israel. Following a recent protest at Massey University in solidarity with Palestine, students found that the university had invested more than $7,000 in Israeli government bonds within the past 3 months. For this week's Get Action, I spoke to Diniti Bowata, a student at Massey and member of Students for Justice in Palestine, who organized a petition calling for the university to disclose its investments and divest from the State of Israel. So to start off, tell us about the petition and your calls to Massey University.
Yeah, so this petition is being run by Massey Students for Justice in Palestine. We're a group of anti-colonial, pro-Indigenous students, staff and alumni from the Oteha campus, the Manawatu campus and the Pukeahu campuses, which are the three main Massey campuses. And we have found that Massey is currently investing just over $7,000 in Israeli government bonds. And our petition is basically asking Massey to divest from those bonds immediately, asking them to disclose any other investments in the Israeli government, in Israeli companies or companies identified by the BDS movement, that's the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions movement, asking Massey University to fully disclose all research collaborations with Israeli universities, institutions and companies, and to encourage all academics to observe the academic and cultural boycott of Israel, and for Massey to take seriously its obligations to Indigenous students as an apparently Titiriti-led university. And we've also reiterated demands made by students across the country to all of their universities.
So how did Students for Justice in Palestine come to find out about Massey's ties to the State of Israel?
So that began with some students at the Pukeahu campus. They painted over the wall of the Fine Arts building in protest, calling for Massey to disclose any ties to Israel. Those students then had a meeting with the head of school, and it was there that they were told about the investment. They also had put in an OIA and received an OIA confirming what the head of school had told them.
Does Massey University have any ethical investment frameworks in place?
Yeah, so apparently Massey University is a signatory of the UN Principles for Responsible Investment. And that is supposed to keep them accountable to better aligning their investment activities with society's environmental, social and corporate governance interests. And so based on that, we think that investing in genocide does not better align with any of those interests.
Does Massey have any other financial ties to the State of Israel or arms manufacturers aside from government bonds?
At the moment, we don't know. We're waiting on finding that information out. But part of our petition is demanding that Massey disclose any and all of those collaborations and investments.
Have Students for Justice in Palestine been able to talk with faculty about divestment or had any response from the university so far?
No, we've had none. All we have had is on the day that we announced that Massey was investing in these Israeli government bonds, the Massey University Instagram page published an opinion piece by the provost saying that Massey University has a right to remain silent on the issue of the genocide in Palestine, which we just disagree with. We think that as a principled university, as a supposedly Tetzvah-led university, we think that Massey University actually has a responsibility to speak up.
So previous correspondence with the faculty regarding the current genocide in Gaza hasn't been going so smoothly, I take it?
No, we just had that one instance of hearing about the investments, and that's all they've told us.
So after Students for Justice in Palestine at the University of Canterbury was able to come to an agreement after their solidarity encampment, are you confident that you will be able to do the same with the faculty at Massey?
Yeah, we hope so. What's great is that we have connections to Students for Justice in Palestine in Canterbury, in Pornicare, up north, across all the universities in New Zealand. And so we're hoping to get their support to try and push and pressure Massey to agree to our demands.
So we're now at the end of the interview. Do you have anything you'd like to finish off with or any closing statements you'd like to make?
Yeah, this petition is open to anybody. You don't have to be a student. You don't have to be Massey affiliated. You just have to be a citizen concerned about the fact that New Zealand institutions are investing in a current genocide and are refusing to speak up and refusing to divest without pressure from us. So please, whoever you are, if you think that this is wrong, please feel free to sign and share our petition.
And that was Dinithi Boata from Massey University Students for Justice in Palestine, talking to us about the petition for the university to divest from the State of Israel. If you'd like to sign this petition, you can find it on our.actionstation.org.nz under the name Massey University Divest from Genocide. You can also keep track of Students for Justice in Palestine at Massey on @massey.sjp on Instagram. We're going to be heading into a quick break, but if you have any thoughts on these pieces, text us in on 5395 or give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Keep it on the B.
Thank you. So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Last week, Te Hiringa Mahara, the Mental Health and Wellbeing Commission, released data on the state of New Zealand youth mental health. It found that while most rangatahi were doing well, there is a steady decline in youth wellbeing in comparison to older age groups more recently, with 1 in 5 young people experiencing higher rates of psychological distress. I spoke to Dr. Ella Cullen, the Director of Wellbeing System Leadership at Te Hiringa Mahara, about this data, the factors contributing to this, and how to better support rangatahi. And so recent data collected by Te Hiringa Mahara has found that while most rangatahi are doing well, there is a steady decline in youth wellbeing in comparison to older age groups. What kind of numbers are we talking about here, and how do these compare to previous years?
Yeah, so the report looks into, so from about 2021 to last year, 2023, kind of using government administrative data. And yeah, as the report sort of talks about, up till about 2021, young people felt, you know, it was easy to be themselves in Aotearoa, which was the same for rangatahi Māori as well, that they had good control over their lives and that the things that they did were worthwhile, which is a pretty positive finding. So around 2021, that was actually the majority of the people that we report against, around 74%. So that's quite a big number. And then post-2021, we do see this sort of gradual decline over the last, yeah, since 2021, in mental wellbeing and a kind of a increase in psychological distress. So that's basically the inverse of the numbers I've just given you around the increase in psychological distress. It's about 1 in 5 young people.
And this decline is most notable more recently. What kind of factors are contributing to negative mental health statistics for young people at the moment? What are the conditions currently causing this, do you think?
Yeah, I guess what we do know from the report and some of the data that we look at are some of those wider root causes of mental wellbeing, and they're both at an individual level, a household level, whānau sort of level. So for example, in our reporting and our assessment, we know that having what is needed, so basic adequate household income or individual income, is a necessary capability for both individuals and families to draw from. So the data does clearly show over the last 3 to 4 years, and coinciding with the cost of living crisis, that basic income for households with young people in them specifically is lower in comparison to older age groups. And that's actually worse for households that have Māori in them, young people, as well as young people with a disability. So there's kind of these compounding, just going from the data, factors or, I guess, areas which really impact on some of those core capabilities that people need.
And of course this brings up a wider conversation about mental health support for rangatahi. What services or resources are available for those struggling at the moment?
Yeah, so we're actually really pleased that there are more options for mental health and addiction support available for young people. So there is the Access and Choice program that we're monitoring as well at the moment that's being rolled out, Youthline, Youth Services. There's an increase in the use of telehealth services for young people, which was a positive finding. Yeah, so there has been sort of, yeah, this general increase in terms of telehealth. Where we are a little bit concerned is that young people do continue to wait longer than older age groups for specialist services. So in the mild to moderate area, there's more options and more support available for young people. And that kind of more severe end, a bit of a longer wait time for access to services for young people.
Right, and I guess with those concerns in mind, how do you propose this issue is better addressed? How can rangatahi be better supported then?
Yeah, so in our monitoring report that we've just released, we do call out, we make a recommendation around having more community options for rangatahi. So that's around, you know, meeting the needs of rangatahi in the community. So rather than going into a hospital setting, we do want to see more services available somewhere in the community. The other really big one for us as a commission is having young people in as part of the decision-making process and design of some of these services. We've heard time and time again from young people that, and rangatahi, that they want their voice at the table, and it's a really big part of the decision making. Another solution is more at the government level around having this longer term investment and addressing some of the root causes of mental distress. you know, so having suitable housing for young people, having that adequate income for young people, it's really, really important that we're also looking at things like tackling discrimination against disabled and rainbow youth, for example. So there's a number of things that government could be doing.
That was Dr. Ella Cullen, the Director of Wellbeing System Leadership at Te Herenga Mahara, speaking to me about recent data on the state of youth mental wellbeing in Aotearoa.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Last week, Justice Minister Paul Goldsmith announced he would introduce a bill to Parliament that would officially make stalking illegal by the end of the year. The announcement comes after an open letter and petition with more than 21,000 signatures called for the government to introduce anti-stalking legislation. The movement to criminalise stalking was ignited after the murder of 21-year-old Fazana Yakubi in 2022, who was stalked for several weeks leading up to her death and was effectively ignored by New Zealand police, as there are currently no laws criminalising stalking. I spoke to the chair of the Coalition for the Safety of Women and Children, Leonie Morris, to discuss why the government has brought the introduction of the bill forward, prevention measures and indications of what the bill might look like. And so previously, Justice Minister Paul Goldsmith had only committed to introducing a bill to make stalking illegal within the political term. What changed for him to bring this forward to having it introduced by the end of the year?
We feel that our public campaign is what changed his mind. We were very lucky in that we were able to partner with Action Station and organise a petition which got over 21,000 signatures. And we also organised an open letter with 50 social justice community groups signing it and over 30 public figures signing it. So those people also got their people to sign the petition.
And to kind of come back to that petition, so this comes after the Coalition for the Safety of Women and Children presenting this petition calling for stalking to be made illegal, of which, as you said, was signed by over 21,000 people. What measures for prevention did that petition call for as well?
We do want prevention measures. We want a public education campaign explaining to people what stalking is and how harmful it is. So that's the main prevention measure that we're interested in. We need the police to be trained in stalking. That would make a huge difference, because at the moment they don't. When people come to them saying, "I've been stalked," they don't unfortunately recognise that stalking is so harmful. So often their complaint of stalking is not taken seriously.
Yeah, to kind of add on to that there, what would you like to see being changed within like police responses more specifically?
We want the police to understand how harmful stalking is, and we want stalking to be illegal. At the moment it's not explicitly illegal, and we want it in the Crimes Act, because while the police do administer other laws in addition to the Crimes Act, it really is the Crimes Act that they take most seriously. So we really need it in the Crimes Act.
Do we have any indication as to whether the calls to introduce these prevention measures will be taken on board in drafting this bill?
That's what our focus is now. So our focus has now that they've agreed to a bill this year. Our focus is making sure that that bill works well for victim survivors of stalking, and also that they look at preventative measures as well.
And really, Aotearoa is quite late to criminalise stalking, with the US, Australia, England, Wales and the European Union already having done so. What is the significance of this bill being introduced?
We think it's very significant because over half of people that are stalked are in a domestic violence relationship, and we feel like this could be a great circuit breaker which allows the police to intervene to stop that ongoing abuse of power over women.
And to kind of come back to what you were saying about it being added to the Crimes Act, well, Labor's Jenny Anderson has said she currently has a member's bill that would add stalking to the Crimes Act and penalise it with a 5-year prison sentence. Goldsmith has said that the government would work on its own bill rather than adopting hers. Was Anderson's bill adequate, do you think? And is the government choosing not to adopt this something you're concerned about?
We thought that Jenny Anderson's bill is excellent. We helped her write it, and we would have preferred it if he had just picked up that bill.
Well, that's all I've got for today. Did you have anything else you'd like to add?
I want to thank all the people that signed our petition, and especially those people that shared it on social media in some way. And if there's people listening to this who are interested in getting involved with violence against women, they are very welcome to join our community group, which is called AVA, and you'll find that online on Facebook and on the internet.
That was the chair of the Coalition for the Safety of Women and Children, Leonie Morris, speaking to me about the government introducing a bill to make stalking illegal by the end of the year.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
Care and support workers, many of whom are working in disability and elderly care here in Aotearoa, will be rallying across the Motu to call on the government to fund a pay equity settlement for the sector. I spoke to Rachel McIntosh from Etu Union, representing care and support workers and organising the rally with PSA and the New Zealand Nurses Organisation to talk about the upcoming rallies and the demands of workers in the sector. So to start off, why are care and support workers rallying this week?
Care and support workers are rallying in support of a long-standing claim for pay equity.
Has the care and support sector had any trouble in retaining workers recently?
Yes, it is. The sector is, like, notoriously short-staffed, and the reasons for that are certainly include the problems with low pay and lack of support. So the work that care and support workers do is skilled. It's much more skilled than people often understand until they understand in detail what the work entails. It carries huge responsibility. It carries responsibility for human dignity for people who are the most vulnerable people in our society. And it's really important. It's vital work. It was essential work. It is essential work, and it has to keep going no matter what. And the pay that people who do this work receive from the employers does not recognise that. And in fact, it is low, and there is no argument that it is low because of historical discrimination, because work that is mostly done by men, which has similar levels of responsibility, which is similarly skilled and which is similarly important to society, is paid at a much higher level. That's why it's unfair, and also it's just really hard to live on the wages that care and support workers receive.
Just for our listeners' reference, can you give us an idea of like what kind of jobs care and support workers work in and who's being affected by low and unequal pay?
There are about 65,000 people who work in the industry, and they do things ranging from mental health support in the community, home support for elderly or disabled or mentally ill people who are living in their own homes and who need support. It is also aged care, so aged care facilities, the kind of support people living in those places require. Yeah, so mental health, disability support, aged care, residential aged care, which is in rest homes and so on, and home support including for people who might be on ACC. So some people just receive that kind of support for a short while. And some people need that support really to be able to live lives with dignity. So things that a young, able-bodied person takes for granted, like just being able to get up in the morning, be able to put your shoes on, be able to, you know, clean yourself and look after yourself. If you require help to do that so that you can basically live as a human being with dignity, that's really important work. That's kind of vital for human dignity. That's the work that we're talking about.
So if the sector isn't able to reach a pay equity settlement with the government, what kind of an impact will this have on the disabled and elderly community here in Aotearoa?
That's a really important point, which is that if people doing the work do not have decent work, do not have work that is satisfying, is well paid, then the people that they're providing the care for can only suffer. You know, that involves people waiting because there aren't enough staff for care. That can involve people sitting in their own waste. This can involve people falling and there being nobody there to find them. So, it can have people hungry because their meals aren't provided on time. It can have people missing medication, and that is because the industry is so stretched. And also even when people do get the care, it's being received from people who are under huge personal stress because they're not paid enough, and they're not given the dignity of decent work so that they can provide the best level of care and those really important interpersonal skills that the workers have. They are under pressure when there's not enough staff and when there's not enough pay.
Are there any recent government policies that have had a further impact on workers in the sector?
Yes, absolutely. The government has increased the uncertainty of work in the sector by reintroducing 90-day trials so that workers, not only are they not paid well enough, but they face the possibility of having no work rights if they get dismissed in the first 90 days. The government has repealed fair pay agreements, which were about setting a minimum standard across the whole industry. That has been taken away, and that is a downward pressure on wages. The government has put up the minimum wage by a pitifully small amount, and when the minimum wage is depressed, other wages get depressed as well. So, yeah, there are many things this government has done that exacerbate the problem.
So, finally, what can our listeners do if they'd like to support care workers and participate in the rallies this week?
Well, people can certainly come to the rallies. The information is available in several places. And if your listeners are in Auckland, there is a rally at Victoria Park at 2 p.m. today. People can come to that. People can also write to the Minister of Health, Shane Retty, and to the Minister of Finance, Nicola Willis, and express their support for this campaign and ask them to, step up, fund the settlement and assist the parties to reach a settlement.
And that was Rachel McIntosh from Air 2 Union talking to us about the upcoming rallies for care and support workers this week.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today, the ACT Party's Laura Trask, the University of Otago's Professor Michael Baker, Diniti Boate from Massey University, Dr. Ella Cullen from Te Hiringa Mahara, and Leonie Morris from the Coalition for the Safety of Women and Children, and Rachel McIntosh from Air 2 Union. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.